Like, ultimately, we don't know how one another's brains work. We don't know what's going to be upsetting for one another. I could, you know, I could name an NPC in a game Catherine and not realize that, like, your mom's name was Catherine and she died last week, right? Like, it's not even, like, big triggering, like, terrible problematic things. It can be just, like, things that we don't know will catch someone else off guard. And just, like, having the tools and the social contract to just, like, prioritize everyone having fun is so important. And that's, like, that's something that I've seen develop in the community over the last 10 years. And it's something that was like a different expectation standard between the first and second edition of Monster Hearts.
Monster Hearts. It's one of the first Powered by the Apocalypse games ever released, yet it's still one of the most popular. Now couple that with the innovated and lauded The Quiet Year, and you begin to see why Avery Alder's name is part of any conversation around the indie RPG scene. Avery and I discuss her games, her creative approach, and her most recent work. Stick around until the end when we get her insights on the rapid growth of the role-playing industry. This episode, and all the content coming from the third floor, are only possible because of the generosity of our patrons. A quick shout-out to some of our most recent patrons. Kevin Radicamir, Philip Cummings, Jonathan Kennedy, Freed, Farty McButterpants, and Johan Hofflin. Because of you and the 100-plus other patrons out there, we're able to bring you content on a weekly basis. All right, sit back, relax, and enjoy my time with Avery.
Do you love to unplug and play games around the table? Greetings, friends and floorheads, to Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars. If you love tabletop gaming, you are in the right place. Listen as Craig delivers in-depth discussions and interviews with game designers, creators, insiders, and experts. Learn from the people making and playing the role-playing, miniature, and board games you love. Now, enjoy the show.
Howdy friends, Craig here. Today we're talking to Avery Alder. Avery is best known for the role-playing games Monster Hearts, The Quiet Years, and Dream Askew. The tagline on her website, Buried Without Ceremony, is games that mean something. It describes her work as games about community, relationships, doubt, queerness, and the collapse of civilization. Avery, welcome to the third floor.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me on today.
So I've really been looking forward to this because, as my listeners know, and you may not, is I took about a 20-25 year break from role-playing games. And when COVID hit, I came back. And needless to say, the landscape of role-playing has changed quite a bit in the last 20-25 years. And there was a few games that constantly came up in conversations as I was talking about, you know, what had happened to games over that time. And your work consistently came up. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I've been doing game design since about 2005 or 2006. So I've gotten to witness quite a few of those transformations as well over that time. It's been really exciting and interesting.
I can't wait to talk about it. But first, we need to figure out how you found gaming. So at one point in your life, Avery, you didn't know you could roll dice, pretend to be other people and kind of participate in the hobby. So I'm wondering if we can go back in time to really your first exposure to tabletop gaming.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because from a very young age, like I think around when I was 7 or 8 or something like that, I have notebooks where I would just like be writing out spell lists or like designing back covers of the video games I would theoretically one day design. And so my first like orientation towards games was, oh yeah, I'll just start making those, even if I don't totally understand what they are yet. But my first exposure to role-playing games was largely, I grew up in a really small rural town and we had one interesting store downtown and it was Lester's Hobbies. And they had magic cards and Dungeons and Dragons and remote control airplanes. And like, I didn't totally understand these things because I didn't actually have the money to buy 3 hardcover books. But I could look at the covers through the glass and imagine what they were. So I spent a long time anticipating the day that I would one day play these shiny games on the other side of the glass. And when I started playing role-playing games, it was D&D 3.5. And it was in high school with my friends. We were about 15. And so the thing about 15-year-olds is they really are convinced that they know everything, right?
That's, we get a lot dumber as we get older, don't we?
Or maybe we get a bit more perspective. One of the two. But we all came in with different visions of what Dungeons & Dragons was in our heads. And I feel like Dungeons & Dragons really intentionally creates that set of mixed expectations for players, right? It promises to be everything for everyone. And so we all came in with different expectations. And one of us would take a turn being the dungeon master. And then by the end of the session, everyone else would be like, this is totally not how D&D is supposed to be. This is garbage. You don't understand the rules. You know, one person would be like, great, you are in Fantasy Village. There is items shop, potion shop, and druid circle. Don't go in the druid circle. There's a level 19 guy who's going to kick your ass. And so at the end of that, we'd be like, this is junk. And then someone else would take over and we'd go on this fantasy adventure. But in the end, like, doo-doo-doo, it was all a dream. And we're all pissed off because it was all a dream. And then I take a turn and I'm like, great. So you are all enslaved gnomes and minotaurs. And this is about like the revolution. And they were like, this is not what D&D is supposed to be either. So we kept on like tearing one another down and arguing about what the game was supposed to be, which got me looking for games that brought more of that clarity to the table.
Right.
I discovered a design forum online called The Forge, which proved to be really influential for me and kind of the generation of designers that I worked alongside emerging in my career. And I discovered a game in particular called My Life with Master by Paul Sega. And My Life with Master is about, it's like, it is the exact opposite of the problem we were having with D&D. It is like, you can't be anything and anyone you want. You are specifically like a feeble henchman to an evil villain in a Central European Gothic village.
Wow.
You live just on the outside of the village. You have one or two like strained potential relationships with villagers. It is about 1847, give or take maybe 5 years at most. It's like, it's very constrained.
It's Tuesday and it's sunny outside.
Well, it's stormy. It's definitely stormy outside. But in this game, you have two stats. You build relationships. There's a specific end game you mechanically trigger at some point where eventually these henchmen, they develop relationships with the community members. There's a redemption arc. They learn to love themselves and eventually they overthrow and attempt to kill their master.
That's fascinating. And to your point, the direct opposite of your initial experience with Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, it was kind of mind blowing because it was very much like, here's your aesthetic. Here's your plot arc. Here's your pacing. And there's a lot of room to tell interesting stories there. But those constraints really created like a creative pressure cooker that might not have been expected. And so that approach to game design really inspired me to try and create things that were like games that tell specific stories. And so that's how I got my start.
It's fascinating to me, Avery, because that is one of the things that I talk about a lot on the show is that was a huge shift. Because if you go back to, you know, the early 90s when I, you know, finished up role playing and took a break, you know, everything was pushing towards generic, right? Generic systems, things like GURPS, Champions, you know, the hero system, things like that. And when I came back expecting one thing, which was a continuation of the progress because, you know, it's all about me. And I assumed that the role playing games all paused until I came back and they didn't. And one of the things that shocked me was how specific games had gotten. And my initial reaction to it was, you know, this isn't what's going on here. You know, you don't tell me how to play my games. Don't, you know, and then I started playing the games. And I was like, holy cow, like, this is amazing to have a system that is so specific. When you think back to your first exposure to that, did you have any initial resistance or did you just fully accept the concept of these constraints?
You know, I think because I had those experiences of D&D where like we actually couldn't play the game because we disagreed about what the game was, that when I hit those constraints, it was like a breath of fresh air. It's like, finally, someone's telling me what to do. Which is like a really funny kind of oxymoronic thing, but
it is.
But the more I've played a variety of games, the more I've fully appreciated, like, I already have permission to tell stories about anything I want. That is already a thing as a human being I can do, and every other human right. being can do. That's not the hard part, right? The hard part is having structure and constraints and meaningful choices that that challenge us to create stories we couldn't have told otherwise. Stories that wouldn't have come to us if we were just sitting around a campfire trying to tell our best story, right? And so that's, I think, what makes role-playing games great, is they push you into situations where you tell a story you couldn't have told otherwise.
Oh, very, very fascinating. So, guys, today I want to kind of pick Avery's brain a little bit and learn about how she approaches and how she makes her games. I get a sense of what drives her creativity, and it sounds like, based off of the conversation we just had, it started very early. And I'd be curious to know what her process entails. So let's find out what inspired her to make some of the games that she's put out. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy Nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
DZ Leergard here, creator of the M3E Crew Builder app. And I'm a patron of Third Floor Wars because supporting great content creators like them is one of the best ways to help grow this game. So to join me and the other floorheads, go to patreon.com and search for Third Floor Wars, and we will see you there.
Right now is the part of many podcasts where someone comes on, interrupts the show, and explains that you should consider paying for the content you're already getting for free. They'll go on and explain that by giving a dollar or more a month, you not only support the show, but you allow the show to grow and improve. Here on the Third Floor, we commit to not interrupting your episode of Tabletop Talk with such a plea. We pledge not to run a spot asking you to go to patreon.com and give a dollar or more a month. Even if there's a link in this show's description, and there is, we won't ask you to click it and become a patron. We won't spend time yammering about the benefits like early access to episodes, getting those episodes without ad breaks, or even getting a chance to play in one of Craig's RPG sessions. Anyway, enjoy this episode. We needed to clarify that we wouldn't do this type of solicitation. So I mentioned, Avery, you know, coming back to role playing and discovering it, and Monster Hearts was probably the work of yours that I heard in the conversations the most. So I want to talk a little bit about that. It came out in 2012, but I would imagine the initial work on that was well before that. So can you give me an idea really where, if we were to forensically go back and discover the beginning of Monster Hearts, where that might be?
Yeah. So Monster Hearts is a game about teenagers who are dealing with all the upside downness of high school and simultaneously all the upside downness of secretly being a monster. And that monstrosity is both literal, like you do turn into a werewolf and eat your classmates and it's a problem, but also it's a metaphor for all the different ways that teenagers are kind of growing unevenly and dealing with dysfunctional personality traits and seeing if they become their best or worst selves in the pressure cooker of high school. And I guess there's two places that it came from. Mechanically, it borrows a lot of the system and the game engine of Apocalypse World. Apocalypse World was by Vincent and McGay Baker. It came out in 2010, I believe. And it was really influential. I think it continues to be influential to this day. Yeah. You are a group of badasses in community in the apocalypse trying to figure out how to navigate that world. But one of the cool things is that the Bakers were really encouraging of people to play around with that system. You know, there was ways in which it was modular. There are ways in which you could kind of plug different elements in or pull different elements out. And so Monster Hearts emerges mechanically from Apocalypse World, but takes it in a really kind of different direction, obviously, and pulls some of the mechanics out wholesale and puts in totally new ones. Strings exist in Monster Hearts, which is kind of like your control over the heartstrings of your fellow characters, and your ability to kind of leverage their emotions to get what you want. So that doesn't exist in Apocalypse World, and that's key to Monster Hearts. But mechanically, it originates in Apocalypse World.
Yeah. Now, so I'd be curious, did you come across that first as being part of the Forge community?
I first encountered Apocalypse World at, I think it's a convention named GameStorm in Portland. Vincent happened to be there as a guest of honor. And at that point, Apocalypse World was in this kind of ashcan beta release version where the playbooks were all these little, like, you take a piece of paper and you cut it in the middle and you fold it in a specific way. So it's like a 16-page micro booklet that fits in the palm of your hand. And the book, I think, had like a hand-bound cover. And so it was this early release kind of special item. And so I got to start playing Apocalypse World when it was in its just like pre-release phase, which was kind of exciting. And I mean, hilariously, the same thing happened as with D&D. I was playing Apocalypse World with a group that had a lot of different ideas about what Apocalypse World was. Luckily, that tension was a lot more fruitful leading out of that group. John Stone Metzger went on to design Dungeon Planet and another thing. I went on to design Monster Hearts. Adam Coble went on to co-design Dungeon World. Daniel went on to become my editor and push back against a bunch of my thinking in terms of how I was designing Monster Hearts. And so Andrew Gillis went on to design Girl by Moonlight. And so there was just this real explosion of creative, moving in different creative directions from that initial Apocalypse World game at that table, which was fascinating. But so that's kind of my origin with Apocalypse World. It's something that my design career bounced off of a lot over many years after initially playing it.
So what came first for you, Avery? Was it this concept of role-playing teenagers and dealing with identity as teenagers and the angst of teenagers and the relationships of being a teenager and that discovery? Or was it Apocalypse World inspired you to explore that? I'm trying to get a sense of chicken and the egg here.
Yeah, I don't know if it's chicken and egg so much as like two cars colliding.
Okay.
So the first car is Apocalypse World. And then the second car is the whole cultural backlash to Twilight.
Interesting.
Now, I've never read the Twilight books. I've watched all the movies. The first one is just genius. A beautiful movie. I will go on a rant about how it's great. Mostly to be contrarian, to be honest, but the thing about Twilight is, regardless of the quality of writing, regardless of the quality of movie making, there was this frenzied cultural phenomenon of dogpiling on the fans of this franchise and talking about how stupid they were. And now these are almost exclusively teenage girls and lonely housewives who like Twilight, right? Like, we know that. And then we just have like all of these like highly educated, you know, college educated men who have a lot of time during their off hours of their programming job to just write 5,000 word blog posts about how Twilight is stupid, picking it apart word by word.
Right.
Right. Do you remember this?
Very vaguely. So my wife is a huge fan of the books, and she had mixed feelings about the movie. She watched them all. So to answer your question, I think I've watched the first movie, and I've never read the book. So my view is limited through her eyes in that respect. I do know what you're talking about happened, but I didn't see it first person. So this is fascinating.
Yeah. So it was just people weren't taking a step back and asking, like, who are we ridiculing? Who are we calling stupid? Does it make sense for 35-year-old grown man on the internet to be spending their days talking about how teenage girls are stupid? Is that a good place for us to move culturally? Or perhaps do we need a different, more nuanced, more complicated approach to talking about these books? And because at the same time, like, there was a Halo novelization series at the same time that there was Twilight being released. No one was going line by line through the Halo books, right? They were trash. Teenage boys loved them. They were giving teenage boys bad gender ideas.
Right.
No one particularly cared. But Twilight was the devil, right? And so, again, I was at the time young and very contrarian. And so the more people said Twilight is trash, the more I was like, no. Twilight is not trash. You're not allowed to say that. I'm going to defend it. I'm going to go to bat to it. I'm going to talk about how it is an important cultural touchstone. And so that's the second car. Apocalypse World is the first car. They smash together one day. I'm just like on the Apocalypse World forums, kind of like putting together almost joke mechanics, right? Like, oh yeah, working on this Twilight game. Haha. Here's my new move. And then someone was like, you should actually make this. And I was like, wow. Oh, you're right. Actually, I didn't realize it, but I have a bunch of feelings about how these stories about the complicated, terrible decisions that teenagers make when they're in love or they're in lust, like those stories aren't given a place at the table yet. And so that's where Monster Hearts came from.
So I'd be curious if we can dig into that a little bit more, because this is fascinating to me. Do you remember the first time you saw the first movie? And did your thoughts about the movie change, or did you start off with an emotional reaction to the movie and then were able to figure out what caused that? Or was it truly, you know, people are pushing against this and I'm going to push back? Or was it all of those things?
Yeah, maybe it was all of those things. I saw Twilight in theaters with someone I had a crush on. I saw it only for the reason that I had the crush on the person who invited me. And I thought it was a whatever movie. And it was absolutely that contrarianness to, like, I don't think we as a culture should spend all of our time ridiculing teenage girls that pushed me into this place of being like, actually, I want to create media that is about this.
Wow, that's absolutely fascinating. So you get you put out your, you know, you're throwing a couple mechanics out there and someone says, you know, Avery, this is, you've got something here. What happens next now? When do you start to really kind of piece together the next iteration of this concept?
I think I dove in and I created a prototype version really quickly, and I got it out there. Yeah. And people started playing it and said, like, it is flawed, but really exciting. And I got cold feet on the project. I think I was like, do I really want to be investing what could be years of my life into bringing these stories about, like, messy, terrible, hormonal teenagers? I knew that the media that I was engaging with was fraught and problematic. Like, that wasn't over my head in any way, but Monster Hearts was working to, like, interrogate that, to, like, spell out, like, here are the mechanics by which this, like, vampire abusive boyfriend, like, holds sway over people, and kind of, I feel like, putting those mechanics into play with this really, like, intentional, like, what do you do when it's spelled out for you, when it's spelled out for your character, or at least for you as a player. There was a queering of the content as well. Kind of leveraging the fact that teenagers are confused and horny and impulsive and constantly vying for power over one another. There's a lot of room for people having feelings that they don't understand and having to grapple with them. And so there's just so much space in the genre to start exploring queer themes, and that opportunity is rarely taken. And so Monster Heart's really pushed in that direction as well.
One of the things that I found fascinating, Avery, as I was learning about Monster Hearts and reading about it, and not only reading Monster Hearts, but reading about Monster Hearts, is the concept of the correct me if I'm phrasing this incorrectly, like the structural conflicts and difficulties between the players. Like one of my initial thoughts was it was interesting that Avery decided to make this a player versus an antagonistic non-player. Does that make sense? It seems like you embraced that, the difficulties and the complicated relationships and the antagonism. And I'd be curious to know, was there a point in time where you said, you know, I'm not going to trust a GM to handle these conflicts? I want the players to handle these conflicts. Does that make sense?
I think it does make sense, because I think that one of the key things that you're getting at here is that the role of the MC or the game master in Monster Hearts is not to be pushing the major plot arc. It's to be stirring the pot.
Yeah.
And what that plot ends up being is mostly tensions between the player characters. Whenever those tensions, you know, they start to die down, people start to step up and be their better selves. The MC reaches in and is like, okay, but what about this twist of the knife? That probably gets you all at each other's throats again, right? And the answer is always yes, because the mechanics really push in that direction. A big part of why I was interested in that is because I was really interested in having a game that was about emotional leverage.
It's very interesting.
And having a game that was about pressure cooker situations. And Apocalypse World, I think, is really interesting because you can have like this like big scary boss in the wasteland, right? Like the villain in the Mad Max movie. And depending on how these roles go, or like these moves that the players make, it's really clear that like, hey, they could just make a series of moves that kills that big baddie. Like, you're not introducing a big baddie being like, this is a level 27 encounter. That's not right on the table for you. You as the MC have to accept that anything you put on the table, they have the potential to blow up. And you're not there to create unsolvable problems. You're there to put danger on the table and see what they do next, and to accept that you don't have control over where the story goes. And so for me writing Monster Hearts, I knew that pressure cooker situation, like, you can't actually introduce it externally. You have to stoke it from within. The players are the ones with the most agency. So you have to invite them to use that agency to get at one another if you want that pressure cooker situation to emerge in the story. Does that make sense?
It does. It makes a ton of sense to me. So, as I talk to designers and creators, I'm very fascinated by, you know, the series of iterations, right? You know, as you go through and you make changes and things like that, can you, looking back at it, I keep hearing about the final aha iteration, and I haven't quite put a word to it, and I haven't heard anybody else put a word to it, but it seems like I keep hearing someone say, you know, yeah, and then, you know, I changed this one thing and all of a sudden it all clicked. I solved a problem that I hadn't even defined yet. And I wonder if that happened with you with Monster Hearts, where there was a moment, and it could be a major change or a minor change through the iterations, where it just all finally fell together for you.
I don't know that there was a turning point where everything suddenly felt like it came together. But there was a point fairly late in the development of the first edition of the game where it felt like that missing puzzle piece was put into place. And that is that the game has growing up moves, and there's kind of this like season by season plot arc kind of set up to the story or to the game, where after a certain point, usually five or six sessions in, you trigger a mechanical thing where, okay, the next episode is our finale. Like, the next time we get together and play the game as a group of people, that's our final session of this plot arc, and then we're going to stop playing. If we want to pick it up again after, you know, we play some D&D or have some board game nights or something. We can do that later. But like, this is, the season is coming to a close. That felt really good because Monster Hearts tends to have play that like starts at a simmer and then quickly gets to a full boil and then is like exploding. And it's only interesting to tell stories that are hovering at that constant explosion place for so long. And so seasons are a way of saying like, we're not trying to do this forever. That wouldn't make sense. Like Becky ate half the football team. You don't come back from that really.
Damn it, Becky.
So we're going to hit our season finale. Now it's prom. And after that, we're done. Maybe we come back for senior year later. Maybe we reboot some of the characters for that. But like, this is our arc. And one of the things that end of season kind of phase opens up is certain season advances. So you can normally, you know, like level up your stats, take new moves. But then these ones, one of the things you can take is growing up moves. And so you've got these normal moves you've been using this whole season that are all about shutting people down, lashing out at people, running away in panic, trying to like get emotional leverage over people. And then suddenly the growing up moves are on the horizon, and maybe you take one of those, and now you can like stand up for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You can broker peace. You can take the high road. And this is just something that you didn't really know how to do before, and now you can do it. And although it's a small part of the game and not one that necessarily every group even like accesses, I think that far off place of, and maybe one day you'll actually grow up and you'll overcome these pitfalls that you keep on falling into over and over again, really helped to frame what the game is about. The game is about contending with your worst impulses and seeing whether you overcome them.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I would imagine too, Avery, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like, you know, by doing that, you know, you make sure that you don't dilute that rolling boil, right? So you if you spend, I would imagine, too much time playing at that apex of the, you know, the beginning of the third act or the mid third act, it dilutes that. But whereas by putting the bookends and having those seasons there, it allows those to not last forever and to be special. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I think it's good to have. It's good to have peaks and valleys in your storytelling, and it's good to have like a direction and counter direction. And so there's a real intention there with like the first session always starts in your homeroom. Like you determine your seating chart and you kind of learn a little bit about your classmates, and then you play out what is typically initially a day where everyone's bored at school. Like there's a little bit of like a finding your ground, and then things slowly start to build, right? Someone passes a note to someone else or something like that, and it builds. And quite reliably, it builds to the place where Becky ate half the football team, or like someone is, you know, putting like a curse on someone else to have all their teeth fall out and have them slowly wither away, or, you know, something, right? People are breaking up. People are getting together behind other people's backs. All of the chaos and drama and tension and all of that. But you don't really want to start there and have nowhere to go, right? And so you start in homeroom. And there's some GM advice that like if you have one of those like big like climactic moments or those big like peaks, maybe like, you know, halfway through your second session, you know, that big fight goes down. Someone dies, someone cheats on someone, whatever. Like you return Monday morning to history class, right? Like you keep going back and being like, and also we're dealing with mundane teenager stuff.
Right.
And then you get to this like season climax and there's like the often big showdowns or big chaos, but you've also got these season advances opening up and there's this offer to turn back from the brink of total mutual destruction.
Which I wish I had in high school.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So when Monster Hearts initially gets out there and it starts to get noticed, it starts to get picked up, I'm always fascinated about a creator's reaction to the reactions, both positive and negative. So when you look back at that, you know, when it's really starts to catch and you really start hearing discussions happening about it. Was there things that were said and done with the game that surprised you in a good way? And was there things that happened with the game that that surprised you maybe and disappointed you a bit?
Yeah, I mean, there was a range of reactions. There were people who said, like, this game is problematic because it deals with teenage sexuality and violence. And it's easy to, when looking at a piece of media, mistake interrogation for endorsement.
Interesting.
And so there are people who said, like, this is problematic. And my response is kind of like, yes.
By design.
by design. And if I have not been accountable in how I have presented that, then that's an interesting conversation. But, like, are these bad people who do bad things? Like, yes. Like most good media, that is true. There was a surprising amount of people who liked the game. I didn't think it was going to have the reach that it did. Because, like I said, it emerged from a cultural moment where people really loved to talk extensively about how dumb Twilight was. And I really came out being like, hey, here's a Twilight game. Not exclusively, but definitely, like, I'm not hiding that route. So a lot more people liked it than I thought. There was one critique that really stood out. And it was by Lillian Cohen Moore. It was an article on a website called Bitch Magazine, which is like a feminist magazine that also does an online portion. And she was talking about how the game explores fraught territory without providing enough tools to make sure that it's done in a safe way. And so that's the am I being accountable in how I tackle problematic media? And the critique really hit home. And so I developed a supplement for the game called Safe Hearts that was about various techniques and tools for playing the game in a way that felt good for everyone at the table. When I went on to do a second edition of the game that got released in 2016, 2017, that became a full chapter of the game. So there's kind of some explicit tools, things like the X card. And there's also just some stuff in there about, like, hey, when you're introducing fraught content, here is how you read the room. Here is how you take a break. Here's how you ask whether people want to go there. And so there's, and then also, like, if something comes up in a game that, like, makes you feel distressed, here's my recommendation on, like, how to handle that. Step one is use all the tools you already have that you've accumulated from across the course of your life, because nobody's going to be able to write a role-playing game that has better instructions for how to take care of yourself than, like, what you already know about yourself. But like, additionally, here is some support. And so that, that felt like a really meaningful critique that I took to heart that transformed the way the second edition book reads. And it also reflects, I think, a trend that occurred in the time between the first and second edition, right? In that period between, like, 2010 to now, there's now a big focus on, like, if you're telling fraught stories, like, have tools for the players to, like, hit the rewind button or tap out or say, like, can we gloss over this? Because, like, ultimately, we don't know how one another's brains work. We don't know what's going to be upsetting for one another. I could name an NPC in a game Catherine and not realize that, like, your mom's name was Catherine and she died last week, right? Like, it's not even, like, big triggering, like, terrible problematic things. It can be just, like, things that we don't know will catch someone else off guard. And just, like, having the tools and the social contract to just, like, prioritize everyone having fun is so important. And that's, like, that's something that I've seen develop in the community over the last 10 years. And it's something that was, like, a different expectation standard between the first and second edition of Monster Hearts.
I was fascinated with the fact that that type of conversation was happening in this part of the hobby, because I was mostly involved in the miniature gaming tabletop hobby. And when I came back to role playing, there was conversations that were happening within this hobby that weren't happening anywhere else that I could see. And it was very, very fascinating. But part of it is, I think, by the nature of what we're doing, right? It's one thing to push some models around and roll some dice and have them, you know, battle it out. We're doing something different with role playing. It was very, very interesting to see that. So, and this ties into really one of the last things that I thought was interesting is how you handle consent from a player to player aspect, right? So, I'm sorry, a character to character aspect. And consent, it feels like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it feels like a big part of the game in dealing with consent from a character standpoint versus from a player standpoint and balancing that. Was that something that you identified early how did that come together for you? Because I found that very, very interesting how it's handled differently and talked about differently in your work.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's there's an important distinction there for sure. Like, we are attempting to tell stories about characters feeling bad and miserable about their relationships with one another. But if we as players sitting around the table are also feeling bad or miserable about our relationships at the table, like, we're definitely doing something wrong. And so there needs to be that kind of like those two levels of awareness of like, of we want to make our characters feel a different way than we feel. And there's a difference between my character hates this and I as a player hate this. But sometimes those really overlap, right? And so having the tools to figure out how your character feels and reacts and also separate tools for how you as a player feel and react felt really important. On the character level, in that fictional level, a lot of the game is about getting leverage over one another. And one of the ways that characters do that is by turning one another on. When your character turns another character on, you get a string on them. So you get power over them. And now they're choosing, like, they're probably feeling flustered. Are they reacting like defensively? Are they panicking and like lashing out at you? Are they like acting foolish and tripping over their own desk? Are they leaning into the feeling? And so there's emphasis put in those mechanics of saying, like, that turns one on move tells you how your character feels. That's not something you have control over. But how your character reacts to their feelings, that is something that you have 100% control over. No one can tell you what you do next. The mechanics do say, listen, you feel this way in your body. Figure out what that means to you. I'm not saying that your character is gay. I'm just saying that when your character got tackled by Brad on the field, slammed down into the mud, and now you're all dirty, that made you feel a certain way. Well, how do you reconcile yourself with that? That's an approach to player character agency that is different from other games. Other games sometimes actually do the opposite, right? They'll tell you what your character does next, but don't have control over your thoughts and feelings. And Monster Hearts just inverts that and sees what happens.
That, you know, I never thought about it that way. That is 100%. That clarifies a lot of it for me, because the discussions that I was reading as I was getting ready to talk to you, I couldn't put my finger on some of it, but that clarifies it perfectly. Awesome. I'm perfect. And it also helps me understand why the second edition came out, and the tools and the changes that you made for that. So, guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to talk about kind of the next big game that Avery put together. It's called The Quiet Year. We'll be right back. Howdy, friends. Craig here. You deserve a new playmat. Here on the third floor, we use Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, almost free of glare, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. You pick a mat, pick a design, and then you pick an overlay, like one for Marvel Crisis Protocol, Star Wars Legion, or even Malifaux 3rd Edition. Those overlays will really speed up your deployment and make the placement of objective markers so easy. Use our promotion code in the show notes to get a 10% discount on your first order.
In the notes of your order, you can even request the Third Floor logo on your mat for free. That makes the best mat in the business even a little better. So get some new mats, save yourself some money, and help support the show. Go to matsbymars.com. All the details are in the show notes, including the discount code. So Avery, soon after, relatively soon after the release of Monster Hearts, we see The Quiet Year come out. I want to do the same thing, if it's okay, and kind of go back and learn where the beginnings of The Quiet Year is. Maybe we should start by giving people an idea of what The Quiet Year is.
Yeah. So The Quiet Year is a weird game. It is mostly a role-playing game. I describe it as a map drawing game about community. And the way that The Quiet Year works is you collectively tell a story about a community that has experienced the collapse of civilization and that has a year of relative peace to rebuild and reassess and figure out what their collective identity is. It is not a story told through individual characters like most role-playing games are. Instead, it's played in turns. Every turn is a week. Every week opens by drawing a card from the deck. As there are 52 cards in a deck, there are 52 weeks in a year. As there are four suits, there are four seasons. And so you proceed through spring, summer, fall, and winter, being kind of hit with new challenges and opportunities and surprises every week, and then determining how you respond as a community. And rather than playing individual characters, you kind of play as the collective of the community, as the currents of thought and the pools of workers and the voices in the town square. And so it is more of a bird's eye view kind of game, but you're kind of choosing every week, like, do we spend this week holding an important conversation, starting an important project, or discovering more about the world we live in? And as you're doing this, you're drawing things on this map that is constantly evolving. And there's a lot of like actual cartography, right? There's mountains and forests, but then there's also like, here's this image of a skull next to a lollipop that represents something. And so at the end, you have this map that is completely unintelligible to someone who has not played The Quiet Year. But if you've played The Quiet Year, looking at it, you know exactly what it is. You're like, that's a Quiet Year map. Don't know what that lizard thing is, but I can see all of the skulls around it and the little dots to mark conversations that occurred. And I get a sense of what probably happened here.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, reading about the game, Avery, and then, hearing you just describe it the way you did, it begs the initial question, like, where the hell did this come from? Like, where are the beginnings of these concepts? Because there's so many interesting different concepts, not only from Monster Hearts, but from what was out there in 2013.
Yeah, it's this one's a little bit harder to disentangle than the Monster Hearts question. The Monster Hearts question was like, I took Twilight and I took Apocalypse World and I kind of smushed them together. But this one, I guess going back earlier in my game design career, I had repeatedly approached design from this place of trying to invert common design expectations. And so my first game that I ever published, Perfect, was about criminals in this kind of Victorian dystopian setting that was all about like repression and stifling the individual will. And kind of it's got this Clockwork Orange, V for Vendetta, Brazil, you know, like all of those kind of like repressive dystopian police state kind of stories. And you're playing people who go out and exercise your will anyways, like people who go out and commit crimes. And potentially these crimes are like robbing banks or things we think of as crimes, but potentially they're things like, even though you have signed an oath to never again speak, you go and like read poetry in this underground group in a cellar somewhere or something like that. So a lot of the stories about people who like connect to art and passion and culture and connection and relationships and revolutionary potential and things like this. And Perfect one of the initial design conceit was that nothing on your character sheet tells you what you can do. It all tells you things you can't do.
Interesting.
Like, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. And you figure out how to be yourself in this world. And that design conceit didn't hold all the way through to like the final development, but that was the impetus. And then right. In 2009, when I released Ribbon Drive, which is a game about road trips and music and self-discovery, at that time, the indie role-playing game design scene was really obsessed with conflict. Every scene had conflict, and there was a conflict role, and you set stakes of the conflict. And it was very like, you'd be sitting down to play, and you'd be having like this nice character dialogue, and someone who was quite design-minded, who was up to date on all the latest design trends, would lean forward and say, okay, but where's the conflict? And I got a bit sick of hearing that. And so Ribbon Drive was designed from this initial place of like, we had a game where there is no conflict. At any point at which there is conflict, the most obvious opportunity is just to take a detour. And we just switch CDs that we're listening to, and you know, the road trip goes in a different direction. What if it was just all about conflict avoidance? And what if that was actually the central theme, and every road trip was ultimately about what you were trying to get away from, and you were all about letting go of your expectations of the future? So this was just like the conflict avoidance role-playing game. And so The Quiet Year, similarly, a lot of the time when we're telling stories in role-playing games, we're telling stories about my character. Right, like my individual and what my individual does with their personal skills. Mm-hmm. And The Quiet Year, I think the initial design impetus was, what if this was a story about our community, our resources, and our priorities?
Well, and it's the other part that I thought was very interesting about it, Avery, and I'd like to get a sense, because I think it might tie to this a little bit, is this is not usually the part of the story that we tell, right? Usually we're going to tell the story before or after The Quiet Year. But this is the downbeat that to that process. So was that also you just saying, I want to tackle a different part of what everybody else is doing right now?
I think so, yeah. And it's interesting because people, especially people approaching role-playing games from like a Dungeons and Dragons background, have often actually used The Quiet Year to create their setting that they then, right, they're like, okay, something apocalyptic happened, then we establish our community, and then our adventurers, you know, after the end of The Quiet Year, that's when our adventurers begin their D&D campaign, which is cool, which is interesting. It's a totally unexpected use case for the game. But also it's like not what The Quiet Year is going for, right? The Quiet Year is going for like, what if stories about how we as a community make choices are enough? What if we don't actually need like that climax ever?
That's it's really interesting, Avery. Very, very interesting. I'd be how do I want to put this? Let's say that I buy The Quiet Year today, sit down, read it, play it, and then we're able to pop back in time to some of the early iterations. What were things that were there at the beginning that are still there now, through all of the different changes that you made to it? What stayed the same?
So the very, very first iteration of the prototype had you drawing a prompt card every week and reacting to that prompt card and then drawing something on the map. I played that version with like a little deck of cards that I put together once. And the person I played it with, another game designer by the name of Jackson Tegu, like looked at me and was like, do you know how a playing card deck works? And I was like, I think so. I don't quite know what that question means. And he kind of broke down, like, there are 52 cards as there are 52 weeks in a year. There are 13 ranks as there are 13 moons in a year. There are 4 suits as there are 4 seasons, 2 light suits and 2 dark suits, as you know, with the positioning of the solstices or the equinoxes, there is, you know, a light half and a dark half of the year. Like the playing card deck is a year. That's what it is. And so obviously
that was
like,
a little mind blowing, I bet.
Thank you for that mind blowing moment. Obviously that is now the basis of the entire game.
That's so funny.
So, I mean, interestingly, like it's such a good conceit, right? That this playing card deck is the year. I actually encountered a friction where 52 turns is just kind of too many turns for the game. It's you randomize the cards in each individual suit, so you actually have 13, 39, anywhere from 40 to 52 weeks total. But there's also like a suggestion early on in the text of like, maybe you want to play a shorter year, just pull four cards out of every season. Make sure not to pull the King of Spades, because that's the card that ends the game. And I actually prefer that variant, but the elegance of that conceit of 52 cards, 52 weeks was too much to ever compromise on ultimately.
Let go of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So similar question that I asked you about Monster Hearts, was there a change that was made through the iterations that you consider seminal or monumental as far as what the game ended up being?
Yeah, the game introduced factions at one point, and then they got eliminated. So that was one of the two things that I considered really pivotal, is the decision like, no, we're really not teams here. We are an amorphous blob of community feelings and community choices. Factionalism can emerge and can shift over time between us players. I can be kind of speaking as the voice of the secessionists for a little while, and then you can be later on. Things can surface and submerge again. But there was no fixed, like, I'm on this side of the community and you're on that side.
Right.
And then the other thing, so in the game has this mechanic called contempt tokens. If ever someone makes a choice that you feel like you weren't honored and respected in that choice as a community member, you know, whoever you're imagining you're thinking as in that moment, you can take a contempt token and put it in front of you. And in the physical version of the game, these are little skulls. So the players are potentially over the course of the year building up small piles of skulls and resentment in front of them and still trying to negotiate in hopefully good faith with their other community members. And contempt tokens kind of represent the fact that, like, ultimately, if we had all the time in the world, of course we would do a thorough needs assessment for every project. We would consult everyone. We would reach consensus, and we would also, like, initiate every project in a timely fashion and complete it on schedule. Obviously, right. If we could do all those things, we would. Because we're, you know, highly intelligent people. But we don't have that luxury, not in the real world, and definitely not in the post-collapse of civilization world. And so every turn, it's that choice of, like, do we spend more time talking? Do we spend more time searching? Or do we just start? And if we just start, who are we pissing off? And if we just delay starting, who are we pissing off? And so contempt tokens, they build because you can't anticipate the needs of the community. And ultimately, you have to take action in various ways. And there was a point at which you could spend contempt tokens to do certain things. And the other pivotal moment was just removing any option to do anything with the tokens other than have them sit in front of you. And so some people say, like, well, that the contempt tokens don't do anything in the game, which I always think is interesting. Whenever someone tells me having visible signs that other people are displeased with me doesn't do anything, that's a very different kind of person than I am.
Right. What are you talking about?
I'm like, oh, interesting. Because when someone has a visible sign of displeasure with me, that forces me to reevaluate my entire life and change every action from that point forward forever.
That's funny.
But they, you can't spend them. It's true, you can't spend them. You can't trigger another mechanical interaction. When there are past grievances, they just linger forever. And that's just a reflection of my experience in community. You can stop talking about it. You can potentially get over it, but they're always still there. Little skulls in front of everyone.
So I'm very fascinated when designers... There's almost like two phases in this process as I'm starting to learn more and more about it, because the one thing I'm not is a game designer. So this is all very interesting and new to me. And I'm very much an outsider and a consumer, right, of the games that people are making. And it's interesting to me, phase one is the design, the iterations, the play tests, the monitored play tests and things like that, where you have control over every aspect. Like literally you could have a game played today and then tomorrow you change it completely, right? Because it's yours. And then at some point it's out there. And you no longer have that control. And I'm not implying that you would want that control, but I am interested when I hear designers talk about what happens when a game like The Quiet Year goes out there. Did you see it being played or discussed in a way that you didn't anticipate?
Sometimes, or actually, I don't think I ever saw it being played in a way that I didn't anticipate, but I did see it being reacted to in a way that I didn't anticipate. Mm-hmm. There are kind of rules. So like when it's your turn and you draw a card, it's your opportunity to make a decision about what the community does in reaction to that card. The other players they're not tossing in suggestions. They're not making the decision for you. It's like, you draw a card and it's like something, an old relic was discovered. Some people say it's cursed. Do you use it or destroy it? That's your choice. And
right.
And so there is because conversations in community are often constrained, like you can't hold a town hall in which everyone gets to speak as much as they want to on every single thing. That's not actually realistic or feasible. And so to model constraints on conversation in community, there is not like a freewheeling ongoing discussion about what people should do next. There's an action of like hold a discussion. And it's like, you open with a question or a statement, you go around in a circle and everyone gets to weigh in with a statement. We're talking like one or two sentences here.
Right.
And so some people, especially people I think who are approaching it with more of a board gamey kind of lens, reacted to that in like a pretty like, cool. So there's really like your turn is your turn. And we're rotating who is constructing the next part of the community story. Some people reacted to that in this really like, these rules are draconian. You must be silent. Like you are not allowed to speak unless it is the ritual speaking, which is like a very extreme interpretation. It's definitely not the intent of the game. The intent of the game is just to empower each player in turn to like make meaningful choices. In cooperative games, I don't know, like in cooperative board games, for example, usually what happens is you sit down with four people. One of the people has played more of this sort of game and can look at the board and can ask what's in everyone's hands and then can like figure out like, OK, if Mary plays this card and then Beth moves on to this space and then John does this and then I do this and then Beth and Mary do this. And then right, like they can just kind of anticipate. And then if people want to win, they just let this person dictate their turns in sequence over and over and over and over again. And The Quiet Year really works to create a different dynamic.
That's fascinating to me, Avery, because it's a challenge that I have playing cooperative games, is stopping myself from being that guy, or allowing it to be a truly collaborative thing. So it's really interesting that you identified that problem and put a solution in place for it. That's fascinating.
Cool. Thank you.
You're welcome. So guys, let's take another quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about a more recent game, one that came out just a few years ago, Dream Askew. We'll be right back.
There are so many online retailers. It can be hard to find one that is trustworthy, has great prices, along with some reliable customer service. On the third floor, we love ordering our gaming goodies from Gadzooks Gaming. Their selection of terrain, miniatures, dice, custom decor, and conversion bits are curated for gamers by gamers. You'll find they have what you need and what you didn't know you needed to take your gaming fun to the next level. If you mention Third Floor Wars in the cart notes of your order, you'll also get a free gift. And you'll help support the podcast. Check out GadzooksGaming.com and mention Third Floor Wars on checkout to get that free gift.
So this, just like, you know, the game we just got to, or really both games that we've already talked about, is a very unique game. It's called Dream Askew. It was released in 2019, and boy, did it get some attention. It got nominated for several Ennies, for the best game, the best setting, and the product of the year. So before I really even want to talk about the game, what was finding that out like?
It was exciting. You know, it's interesting because I've been invited to be a speaker or a guest of honor at a bunch of conventions. I've gotten to be flown around to do workshops and things like that. And whenever people are like working on writing an introduction for me or a bio or a little splash thing on their website, they will often say award-winning game designer Avery Alder. And I like always have to, it's really unfortunate, I always have to correct them and say like, actually, that's not true. Actually,
I'm an award nominated.
I won like a side award on a 2012 indie RPG awards thing, but I don't quite feel like that is the level of prestige that one requires to be introduced at conventions as an award-winning game designer. So I'm always like, well, you could say award nominated game designer if you want to.
Yeah.
And so Dream Askew, getting nominated for these awards was really exciting. It's actually a book that contains two games, Dream Askew and also Dream Apart, by a collaborator named Benjamin Rosenbaum. And so these are two games that kind of exist in dialogue. They use the same system and explore it in really different settings and different kind of directions. But it getting nominated for these awards was really exciting. At the same time, there's kind of this bittersweetness where the Ennies is... it is really oriented towards broad mainstream appeal. It tends to go towards Wizards of the Coast or Pathfinder, Paizo, like products. And if not those, then like something really interesting in that fantasy adventure game still. And so, yeah, I had this feeling of like, oh, this is great. Now I can put multiple award nominated game designer. But yeah, I don't know. I'm really proud of the book. It was exciting for it to get that kind of recognition and that kind of platform. I didn't expect it to win those because a book that contains a game about a queer collective trying to rebuild their community and a game about a Jewish shtetl community navigating relationships in the mid-1800s like probably isn't going to hook the Ennies audience in particular. But it was exciting. It was an honor to be nominated still.
So I'd be curious, Avery, was your connection with Benjamin early on in the process or was it late in the process?
Well, so in 2013, I put out a prototype version of Dream Askew as a Patreon release. And at that point, I was like, great, this is a 13-page game. People will be able to figure it out if they can and not if they can't. And I'm done with it probably. And then a couple of years later, Benjamin emails me and says like, hey, I've been working on this game that I want to explore about life in a small Jewish shtetl community. And I actually want to use your framework and your game engine. So I have your blessing for that. And I said, yes, just like keep me in the loop and show me what you're working on. And Benjamin comes back and has these innovations on the system. And I'm like, oh, that's really exciting. I want to steal that back for Dream Askew. And then I guess if I did that, I would do this. And then Benjamin would be like, that's really great. And if I incorporated that, then I would do this. And so we started kind of bouncing back and forth. And it pulled me back into working on Dream Askew. And Dream Askew was really like transformed by Benjamin's ideas. And it got to a place where we decided like it would be really cool to release these two games as a book to include... like how to play these games, all the materials for Dream Askew, all the materials for Dream Apart, and then a chapter on how to design your own games using this game engine. So yeah, it was a really cool back and forth, like kind of cross-informing one another's designs while still having the autonomy to say like, as a designer, I'm not including that in my game. My game is different in this way, which was really fruitful.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, it was a situation where you were working together, but not to make the same game, but you were still bouncing off of each other.
You know, it was really cool because often with collaboration, it provokes for me a sense of fear. I really love the idea in theory of collaboration. I'm like, that's so utopian to be all working together on art projects. But the moment someone, you know, like I can kill my own darlings in game design.
Yeah.
But the moment someone else threatens to kill one of my darlings, like it's hard for me to access that openness and vulnerability that leads to good creative process, right? Like I get defensive. Yeah. I think that's a normal, natural human reaction. Collaboration is really hard. But the fact that we both had like our projects that existed in dialogue, but that were ours, like ultimately I could say like, cool, our games are not moving in the same direction anymore. It took the fear out of that process and allowed me to be a lot more open. So yeah, it was a really cool way to get to collaborate.
I bet. Now, so thinking back on it, because it could have just as easily been Craig that emailed you and I said, hey, you know, Avery, I've got this idea, and you and I could have ended up collaborating. I'd be curious to know, when you think back on it, what was unique about you at the time and maybe unique about Benjamin at the time that allowed this to work at all?
Yeah, I think one of the factors was that I had written this game about queer community. And, you know, part of the premise of Dream Askew is that, like, you are living in the post-apocalyptic world, but there's never going to be one event, right, where suddenly everyone goes from living their normal life to living in the wasteland. Like, there's always going to be waves of events, just like there are now, right? There are economic crises, there are civil wars, there are things which tear parts of the world up, or that take a whole class of people and kind of leave them on their own to fend for themselves. And so Dream Askew kind of just accelerates that into the near future and says, like, as a queer community, you have recently fallen out of the society intact. Like, your apocalypse came. Now what do you do next? And so there are still people who have, like, you know, air conditioning in their fancy Lexus. They still have shopping malls. They still have gated communities. They have working electricity and running water. You don't. You live out here. So how do you make it as a community? And when I designed this, I was really like, this is a game about queer community and like queer separatism. And when Benjamin came to me with his idea for his game about Jewish ghetto life, Dream Apart, and the kind of like the fantastical and the surreal and the whimsical that could exist in that setting, it helped me to better understand what the game that I had written was about. It was about finding belonging because you collectively exist like outside of a larger society, outside of belonging. And so the engine for the two games ended up becoming, it's named Belonging Outside Belonging. So they're both games of belonging outside belonging. And yeah, it was really getting to see the ways in which Benjamin was mirroring my design back at me that helped me to better understand kind of the breadth of and the point of what I was designing.
Yeah. So were there times where Benjamin would put that mirror up to you, Avery, and it was easy to digest what you saw, and other times when it was hard to digest what you saw?
I think it was mostly easy to digest. I guess the thing that was hard for me is that the first design thing that Benjamin came back with was he introduced key relationships in the community, like circle two relationships you have to NPCs in the community. And at the time, Dream Askew didn't have that. And it made me really look at it and be like, oh, I like said I was making a game about queer community, but like mostly
you're just community
like,
part.
you're picking out what your hairstyle is and like how you look and what cool stuff you do. Like, this is about queer aesthetics. This isn't yet about
isn't
queer
that
community.
Funny?
And so that really pushed me to be like, okay, obviously relationships with other people needs to be much more central. And I want to build on that by designing this community worksheet that you put in the center that has like a map and some community conflicts that you highlight at the start of play. But that kind of struck me, and it caused me to reflect a bit about what I mean when I say things like a queer community.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. I can't imagine what that experience must have been like. And there has to be a degree and credit to you of self-awareness and to a certain degree, maybe a self-confidence that allows you to reconsider things like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I don't know that the, I don't know if I would describe it as self-confidence, but luckily I had, I guess, the ability to push through embarrassment. Maybe I would describe it as.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. And was that you, some of your initial feelings, you know, especially in that instance, is like, I can't believe I missed this. I'm so embarrassed.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's my initial reaction to almost everything in life. So
that's fascinating. Guys, we're going to take one more break. When we get back from this break, I'm going to take advantage of something that we really talked about in the first segment. And that is the fact that Avery has been connected through kind of the overarc of the changes in role playing. And I really want to pick her brain about it. We'll be right back.
Howdy friends, Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com. That's with one M. Or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code Third Floor Friend, all one word, THIRDFLOORFRIEND, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats.
So listeners know that, you know, part of what has prompted me to really focus on the RPG industry and people that are creators within this industry is I was just fascinated with the level of change that happened in the last 15, 20, 25 years in the game. And Avery, you know, we talked about it the first segment, you know, how you watched a lot of that. And I think that there's going to be a time where, you know, doctorates will be written about kind of what happened and how suddenly we now, I think, are at a golden age where role playing is more popular than it's ever been. When you kind of sit back and think about it, Avery, what are some of your takeaways in being a historian? What do you think are some major moments that led us to where we are now?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a big question. I think, we're
going to do four more segments on it, right? Sorry, it was a big question.
No, it's great. I definitely think there have been waves of kind of like influence on the direction of design. When I started role playing, the D20 open source license for D&D 3.5 or 3.x was a thing. And there was just thousands of splat books and spin-off settings and games based on D&D. You know, there's so many books with like 13 new classes, 14 new fantasy races, 450 new weapons, 120 new relics, 58 new spells. And so that was kind of like this wave. And what I really loved about the first design community that I came into, which was the Forge, as I mentioned earlier, which like wasn't perfect. No design community or movement is ever going to be perfect. But what I really loved about it is that there was this big push to be like, you can design games that are about a specific situation that put specific and interesting constraints on the players. And you can design your system from the ground up. Like your mechanics are created to tell the story that you want to be told at the table. And so there is this huge wave of games that push towards interesting conflicts that had bespoke, unique mechanics and unique engines to tell different kinds of stories. And so that was kind of the wave that I initially entered design on that I feel like really flourished from 2003 to 2009 or maybe a bit beyond that. And then this new wave started with Apocalypse World, where there was this game engine that could do really interesting things. Mechanically, at its base, one of the things that was going for it is that you roll 2d6. That creates this nice bell curve. Most results fall in the middle. Any result, you know, roll 2d6, add your stat. Any result that's 6 or lower is like a failure or a, you know, a messy situation. Any result that's 7 to 9 is a complicated or partial result or partial success, or like you get what you want, but you have to make a hard bargain for it. And then a 10 up is like, great, you did it. But I hadn't really encountered games before that that had those 7 to 9 results, right?
Right.
There was a lot of like conflicts for either won or lost based on how you engage with the mechanics. In Apocalypse World, because of that 2d6 bell curve, like you're just always shooting towards this messy partial result. And that was what was really interesting mechanically. And then the other thing that's really interesting is that it's like you're just having a conversation at the table until you say something that triggers a move. And when you trigger a move, you know, you roll the dice and you interact with the mechanics and you find out what new direction it shoots you in for your story. But the modularity of moves combined with that 2d6 system that really pushes you towards partial success, alongside the invitation for people to make Apocalypse World their own, to tinker with it, and also to hack the system to design their own games, led to this flourishing of a totally new wave of independent role-playing game design that I hadn't really seen elsewhere, of being like, we're going to use the Apocalypse World engine to create a game that's what's called Powered by the Apocalypse. And there are hundreds, yeah, maybe thousands, honestly, of World games. Monster Hearts is one of them. Masks by Magpie Games is one of them. Bluebeard's Bride is one of them. Dungeon World. There's a lot of games that have had really big commercial and or critical success that have emerged from that. But also, like, it's really empowering to newer designers or to like designers who don't have the same amount of resources to say, like, here's this engine you're free to use. And you can plug in your own stuff to it and see what happens. And so now we also see like Blades in the Dark by John Harper was released. And there's this, and you can use this engine for your own Forged in the Darkness game. And there are maybe dozens, I think, Forged in the Dark games. And it started we started seeing this shift. Evil Hat Games put out Fate Core and Fate Accelerated, which is it's moving back towards that universal generic rule system kind of thing. But it has, again, that like modularity and encouragement to like plug your own stuff into this engine. And so we're still in that wave of people being really excited to tinker with one another's engines. Dream Askew, in some ways, is a Powered by the Apocalypse game, but it's diceless and it's GM-less, and it definitely goes far afield. And then it becomes its own engine that other people can do their experiments with. And the same is true for Blades in the Dark. I think it is like a Powered by the Apocalypse initially game that becomes its own engine. And so this engine's inspiring new creators to develop new experimental work, which then gets like formulated into a new engine that people can play off of, is it's this really fascinating design wave. And I'm curious, I had this hunch that we're going to see like a pendulum swing in another direction again, maybe back towards like every game pushes towards its own unique kinds of conflict and has its own bespoke, unique mechanics, like we saw coming from a lot of those earlier Forge games, or maybe like right. In a totally new and unpredictable direction. I have no idea, but it's been interesting to get to witness a couple waves and then to be able to look back a bit more historically and start to be able to identify the waves that were occurring before I was present as well.
Is there things that you're seeing out there right now, Avery, that really excites you about the industry? And it could be from a design perspective, from a consuming perspective. What excites you right now about what's out there or what's coming, maybe, that you're seeing maybe just over the horizon?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that has become really clear to me in the last few years is that there are a lot of different avenues to like getting your work out there as a game designer. I started designing at a time and in a particular community where there is a really big emphasis on, like, you should do it yourself. It should be creator owned. You should control your artistic work. You should get to make these choices. It's not hard. You don't need to break the bank. You don't need to take out a mortgage. Like, print on demand technology exists. There are cost effective ways to do this, but you should DIY it so that you own it and it's yours. And that is still the way that I produce almost all of my work. And I think that at the time it was a reaction to the fact that it was that or freelance. And when you freelanced, you made 2 to 3 cents per word, and the publishers were not trustworthy. And so those were kind of like the two options for you.
Yeah.
And now what I'm seeing is, like, with Patreon and itch.io and the digital tools that, like, a wider variety of people have access to, it's really easy to DIY it on kind of on any scale, right? On creating a 3-page game that 47 people check out, to doing, you know, large print runs and, like, working with distributors. Like, it's all possible to do that DIY. But I also see interesting things, like Evil Hat Games has worked with a variety of designers to put out their work. Blades in the Dark was published in that way. April Walsh's game Thirsty Sword Lesbians is being released in that way. Jamila's game Apocalypse Keys, which is like a Hellboy BPRD based game, is being released through Evil Hat. And they seem to have this, like, really new model of, like, you are the designer. What we are bringing to the table is, like, an editing team, resources and capital, you know, like, all of these, like, tools and supports that you wouldn't have if you were doing this alone. But we're not, like, trying to, like, own your words, and we're not trying to, like, take them from you. And so there's kind of new modes that I'm seeing of, like, publishing collaboration. And so it just feels like what is really great about right now is that there are just, like, so many different options on the table for, like, how do you want to be putting your game design work into the world? I don't think they're all necessarily, like, financially viable if you want to be a career designer. I think that there's still a real limited narrow range of what you can do to make it in terms of, like, making a self-sustaining career out of it. But in terms of, like, you want to be designing games, putting them out there, getting paid for your work on some level, like, there's an amazing breadth of options.
I completely agree. And I'd be curious, Avery, when you think about it. So, you know, to put a big category, let's, and this is problematic, but I'm going to kind of categorize it anyway, because it helps with my next question. The big tent of geek hobbies, right? Whether it be comic books, whether it be tabletop role playing, tabletop miniatures, you know, all of those things. I mean, all have grown and are more popular now than I think they were before. But it seems to be to me that there's been a more exponential growth to role playing specifically. Versus the others. And I wonder whether you have a sense of A, if you agree with that, or, and if you do or don't, B, why that is. Why do you think it's been different for role playing?
Yeah, I mean, I think based on sales data that is publicly released, I'm pretty sure that it is just quantitatively correct that role playing games are selling more, and then we can assume as a result of that being played more. But I think one of the other things that's occurring is that we've also seen the birth of streaming, and we've seen the birth of people playing games visibly. Things like Critical Role, but also smaller games and smaller channels. And so we've seen in podcast, in video, different ways that people are suddenly making their play more publicly visible.
Yeah.
Which has been interesting for me to experience, because what I have loved about role-playing games is that they are not performed for an audience. They are something you do together that is ephemeral, that is gone once you're done it. And that's not always true anymore. Now, role-playing games are often performances that are done for an audience. that are done for money sometimes. And and so, yeah, that's been an interesting twist. But I think one of the things that's happened is while role-playing games are getting more popular, simultaneously, role-playing game play is becoming a lot more visible through podcasts and through streaming. And so we're kind of seeing this, like, this double expansion of exposure, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like the fact that, Avery, that you talk a little bit about what's problematic about actual plays as well. Because I think that that's true, too, because that is definitely one of the things that I notice is, like, I can watch people play role playing games. When I was playing role playing games, it was like the secret code. Like, do you play D&D? I said, why? Let's go play D&D. It wasn't something that you just kind of did out in front of everybody. But, you know, it makes me think about your comment about Twilight. At the same time, when I played role playing games in high school, it was just me and my buddies around the table. And when we got done, we got done. And, you know, nobody could go back and pick apart and, you know, tear into something that may have been said or done on that, where that's not the case with actual plays. Those are permanent. Do you think that that's changing role playing because that's possible, or creating problems?
So I don't think it's limiting it. I do think it is having an impact. I think that I don't necessarily know that the average person who both plays role playing games and takes in actual plays has developed a complete consciousness around the idea that, like, what we see done for the camera is different than what we do at home. And that's something that, like, with anything, right? Like with reality TV, with watching pro wrestlers, right? Like it does, yeah. with so many things, like, we need to develop that, like, media literacy where we can recognize that, like, this on-screen activity is not the same as what we do at home. Even if they're using the same rule set and it's closer, maybe in the case of streamed role-playing games. And I know that for me, like, some of the most impactful role-playing games that I've ever played that have like caused me to think about myself differently or think about the world differently, that have been really powerful, whether they were like that on purpose or they were like, we're goblin adventurers and whoops, we just happened to like hit something really poignant and now we're all reflecting accidentally. Like either way, like though there's a level of vulnerability and trust,
yeah.
And also like permission to explore and experiment in I guess a safe space is the best word for that. That like I wouldn't have had that same learning and growth and vulnerability. I wouldn't have gone there if it had been, you know, like somewhere between 2,000 and 2,000 people are watching this as it happens.
Right. Yeah.
And maybe some people are more confident than I am. I mentioned earlier, my natural reaction to almost anything is embarrassment. And so maybe other people don't have that same shift in how they play when something is on air. But I know for me, like, it really impacts where I want stories to go.
Well, just by the nature, an observer always changes the situation. I to get, you know, ethereal about the whole thing. But it's something that I have just started thinking about. And a lot of the ideas that you talked about is something that I've been noodling on. So that was helpful. Is there anything that concerns you about what's happening now or things that are happening that maybe scare is not the right word. Maybe concern is the right word.
Mostly not. Mostly I think that is great that games are being played in new ways, that people get to engage with games in new ways. I think the one thing, the one worry I have, I guess, since you're asking, is that, like, if a channel gets really popular, it's going to have a really big audience. When it has a really big audience, that means a lot of people are going to assume that the way one plays role-playing games is the way that is shown on that channel. And if that channel has a big audience, they're probably, like, getting money when they make those episodes. And in order to maximize money, you want to make sure that you cut down on dead air or uninteresting TV. And things that probably make for uninteresting TV are a lot of the prep work where you build trust, where you talk about safety tools, where you figure out, like, what vibe are we wanting to go for? Because that stuff just, it doesn't make for good television. Spitballing where you, like, toss out a bunch of ideas and then, like, decide not to follow through on 90% of them doesn't make for good TV. I guess, yeah, that would be the worry, is that people coming into role-playing games see these people who are just diving into, like, high-intensity conflict-laden stories without doing the setup work that builds the trust that makes the table functional. Like, that's definitely happening, I'm sure, but it's happening off camera.
But you have that next phase of danger, right? So it's one thing to say that it is happening, but they don't have the visibility to it. But then there's a next generation of that where people go, well, I didn't see it happening, so we're not going to do that. And that could create a terrible situation, right?
Totally. And we talked earlier about how safety tools and kind of the ability to build that trust at the table and regulate and restore that trust at the table. Like, we've developed so many interesting tools for that over the last decade or so, I would say, in particular. Yeah. If those don't make it on the air, we start to lose them again.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. Well, Avery, I can't thank you enough. This was a fantastic conversation. For those people that want to get more of you and what you do, what is a good resource?
Yeah, so I publish all of my work under Buried Without Ceremony. So buriedwithoutceremony.com. That's where you can find my games, Monster Hearts, The Quiet Year, Dream Askew, Rip and Drive, all of the ones that we talked about today and that we didn't. It's also where you can join the Goblin Friendship Club, which is my Patreon-esque seasonal kind of like newsletter. I share gifts with the Goblin Friendship community. And it's also where you can find links to talks and workshops that I've done. I try to, anytime I get invited to go somewhere and present, I try and turn that into a resource as best I can for the future. And so if you're interested to kind of pick apart various design ideas, there's some links there. And then I'm on Twitter at Lacking Ceremony, which is both my personal and professional. It's like that complicated, muddy mix. but yeah, Lacking Ceremony on Twitter.
Excellent. I will have links to all of that in the show notes. I will warn you, and this is your fault, Avery. I lost about an hour of my life getting lost in your website. There's a lot of stuff there, and it was very, very fascinating. So that's my warning to everybody that you want to set some time aside, because it's not a website that you're just going to gloss over. So thanks, Avery. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And for those of you that listened to the end, thanks for listening. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Subscribe to Tabletop Talk and share it with your friends. Check out our content on YouTube and Twitch. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and stay updated on everything coming from Third Floor. All the links are in the show notes. Take care, floorheads.
Wow, that collaboration thing is amazing to me. I don't think I completely understood how that all came together. That had to have been amazing. An amazing experience.
It was really cool. And the fact that it started in such a casual way,
yeah,
made it like kind of a bit of a like a slow burn that I didn't expect,
yeah,
to have that power. I'm going to share with you a link that you may want to put it in your show notes. It's to an yep. hour-long talk I did at a game design conference called Practice, which is a kind of an industry conference that's really focused on like the minutiae of game design. There's a lot of game design conferences that are like big picture stuff, like PowerPoints with just like one word where you say innovation, and this one's like, no, we want you to take like the smallest, most granular design thing you can and talk about it at length.
Fascinating.
So,
all right, I have got that in my notes right now. Thank you.
Great.
All right, and let me save it because I'm an idiot. There we go, saved.
Hey, are you still here? Look, the podcast is over. And you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, you might as well run over to patreon.com and become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast too while you're at it, on whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.